Organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. And for more information, make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org to learn more about PAX Inc., the members, their missions, all the things that PAX Inc. does for the black community. And while you're on there, make sure you click on the tab that says The Code so you can learn more about the codes of conduct that were created by PAX Inc. to help black America work more as a cohesive unit. As you already know, while you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com to hear the playback of your favorite shows, to learn more about myself, Jamie, Patrick, as well as our great guests, because we always have great guests. Follow the Freedom Train on Twitter at Freedom Train Net. Follow the Freedom Train on Instagram at Freedom Train Network. Subscribe to the Freedom Train on YouTube. Subscribe to the Freedom Train on iTunes and or Google Play. And, you know, like our Freedom Train Facebook page. That way you have so many options and so many ways to stay up on what we got going on here at the Freedom Train. And we're just doing what we do. So, Pat, Jamie, what's going on, fellas?
What's cracking?
You tell us, Sergeant.
Nah, man. It's everything good on my side, man. We getting it bracking over here, blood.
Whatever you call it, man. Whatever
I was going to say, what is a bracking? What is?
Because you're not from Bompton, bro.
what's
you got to replace all your C's and B's and stuff like that. Come on, Pat, man.
Oh,
you don't cold.
I got you. I cracked the code.
Yeah. I'm trying to be cool, and you messing it up for me, man.
I'm sorry, man. I'm
Jamie been cold. Eating poking beans, watching hood movies.
Yeah. I just cool got done watching.
It's a state of being for me, so, you know, it requires work.
Y'all boys crazy. Hey, man, we got a good show once again. You know how we do at the Freedom Train. And today we're going down one of my favorite lanes, down this historical trail. So we have a great brother on the show today, my a good brother, Christopher Everett. Shout out to Dr. Samora Swaggart for hooking us up so we can have this interview with brother Christopher Everett. But before we get him on, I want to give you a little background information about Mr. Everett. So Christopher Everett is a writer, film director, and film producer from Laurinburg, North Carolina. He has experience in film, graphic arts, and marketing. He is a 2002 graduate of King's College in Charlotte, North Carolina, with a degree in graphic design and graphic arts. He recently directed his first feature-length documentary film entitled Wilmington on Fire, which chronicles the 1898 Wilmington Massacre in Wilmington, North Carolina. The film has won numerous awards and has screened at several universities and film festivals, such as the 2015 Cook Lawrence Film Festival, the 2016 North Carolina Black Film Festival, the 2016 Sankofa Film Festival, the 2017 Pan-African Film Festival, and recently the 2017 Longleaf Film Festival, in which Wilmington on Fire won Best Historical Documentary Feature. The film has also broken two film festival attendance records. It broke the attendance record in the 2015 Cook Lawrence Film Festival for most attended screen ever in the film festival's 21-year history, and it broke the attendance record in the 2016 North Carolina Black Film Festival for most attended screen ever in the film's 15-year history. So once again, hailing from North Carolina, we'd like to welcome our good brother to the Freedom Train, Brother Christopher Everett, the director of Wilmington on Fire.
Hey, how's it going?
How you doing, my brother? Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
No problem, my brother, no problem. We're eager to learn more about you, this film, and different ways that we can support what you have going on, because I think what you're doing is great, and we've seen the film. It's a great film, so, you know, we don't want to keep the audience waiting. So, Patrick, you got the first question. Let's do this.
Yeah, and I want to say, before we start, you know, I appreciated you doing the film. I heard about the film through the social media campaign build-up before the film was released, you know, and I got excited because, you know, I'm a book nerd and a history nerd as well, so it's very rare that I'm introduced to something that I am not informed of, and the social media build-up, you know, kind of was like, whoa, wait. There's a documentary on Wilmington, and at the time I was living in Greenville, which, you know, wasn't too far from Wilmington.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, let me look into this. And I ended up becoming obsessed with the story. And it was, you know, if you hadn't been doing what you were doing, I wouldn't have even, you know, that wouldn't have been something that would even register. So, you know, definitely appreciate that. So... Welcome to the Freedom Train. So give us some background information. You know what I'm saying? Let us know about yourself and, you know, like what prompted you to go into this story in such a way and even then to move on to decide I'm going to make a full-length feature documentary about this story.
Well, you know, my name is Christopher Everett, man. I'm born and raised in a small town in North Carolina called Laurinburg. You know, it's not too much to it, man. It's just a regular small country town. But, you know, I always, you know, growing up, always wanted to, you know, make films. But I really didn't see that as a possibility until I left, you know, Laurinburg and went to college. You know, when I moved to Charlotte. And I went to school for graphic design at King's College. And that kind of got me into the world of being creative, you know what I'm saying, through whatever graphic arts and freelance projects I was getting myself into. You know, it allowed me to be creative and experience a whole new world out there, you know, for being creative. And then after a while, I started doing acting, man. I was about 100 pounds lighter back then, though. You know what I'm saying? And I was doing the whole acting and modeling thing, man. That's what kind of got me into the whole thing with film. And then I tried to make the move to Atlanta, I would say about 2007. And I wanted to go down there because Atlanta was just getting popping with the whole acting and, you know, and the film industry down there. So I was trying to get down there early on it. But, you know, things just didn't work out, man. And so I just kind of gave up on that passion. And then I said, you know what? I want to start making, you know, my own films. You know, I'm tired of always complaining, you know, that Hollywood won't make films that I want to see. So I said, you know what? I'm going to start my own production company, and I'm going to make the type of films that I want to see and the stories that I want to tell. You know what I'm saying? Also, and other people that are interested in these type of stories that I want to put out, too. So I said, you know what? Let me form my own little company. I'll be an entrepreneur with this thing as well, plus, you know, make my own films at the same time. So I say it was about 2010 when I decided just to do my first project. And I kind of stumbled upon the whole 1898 Wilmington Massacre story. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with 1898 Wilmington Massacre, it was pretty much one of the only coup d'etats that have ever happened in America. And a coup d'etat is like an actual overthrow of a government. And that's what happened. And that's what makes this story, you know, significant to, you know, what you might have saw with Rosewood and in Tulsa, where in this incident, they actually not only killed, you know, a large number of black people and also exiled them from the city and stole property, but they also took over the government, meaning that they took, you know, they made the mayor step down, they made the black aldermen and the black police officers and the black firemen also stepped down as well and forced them out of their positions and ran them out of town as well and just replaced the whole government with a white supremacist, regime. And that's what made this story real significant. And also, it just wasn't in Wilmington. They did this all over the state of North Carolina. And it was a full statewide white supremacy movement, and that led to Jim Crow segregation throughout North Carolina as well. So I knew that this subject matter was real big, and I saw that no one actually did a documentary on it. You know, you had a couple of little student stuff here and there, you know, people playing around with some stuff on YouTube, putting some little slideshows together, you know what I'm saying, of some pictures.
Uh-huh.
But no one actually did a full production documentary on this thing. So I said, you know what, even though I don't have no money and no resources right now, I know that my people back in the day, they didn't have any resources either, but they still found a way to do it. So I said, you know what, I'm going to do the same thing. And it took me 4 years to do it, but we made it happen.
So without, you know, you kind of went into a little bit about what the movie's about. Could you kind of give us a brief synopsis of, you know, what the movie's about? And also, could you tell us what historical lessons you learned yourself while making this film?
Yeah. Well, the film is about, man, it's a feature-length documentary that gives the ins and outs of the 1898 Wilmington Massacre, pretty much showing from beginning to end. You know, showing how Wilmington was North Carolina's most progressive city back then. It was one of America's most progressive cities back then, where you had African Americans thriving. You also had African Americans and with pretty much combined with the white coalition working together, you know, side by side, trying to make the city a place for everybody. You know what I'm saying? Also trying to not only, you know, the city of Wilmington be a place for everybody, but they wanted the whole state of North Carolina to be for everybody. They really were trying to be a model for this whole Reconstruction movement, you know what I'm saying, during that time. And the film shows how you had still yet a lingering white supremacy movement that pretty much still was there from the Civil War. Because mm-hmm. when you look at it and you study and research, the main people behind the 1898 massacre fought in the Civil War. They fought for the Confederacy. And you know, a lot of them had high-ranking, you know, positions within the Confederate military. And they wanted to pretty much break up that black and white coalition and bring those white folks back to the Democratic Party. Back then, that was your party of white supremacy at that time. And they wanted to bring those people back. So we break all that down in the film. We show the different organizations such as the Red Shirts, the White Government Union, all these different ways that they were able to pull off this massacre and this whole overthrow of the government, not only in Wilmington but throughout North Carolina as well. And we also talk about certain ways they did it with propaganda. They did it through the court system. They did it through the laws and all of that stuff, man. So the film really breaks down the whole nine. You know, it goes across the spectrum of how they did it, why they did it, and how they were able to pull it off and cement it, you know, this whole movement of white supremacy that still is in effect to this day, especially in North Carolina and especially in Wilmington today.
Okay. Okay. Now, like I said earlier, I'm a history buff, so I definitely jumped at the opportunity to have you on this show so we can learn more about this massacre that happened and just about everything that went into making this documentary and being able to be displayed to the masses so black people and white people both can learn about what happened in Wilmington. Now, one of the most important components of that documentary was your cast in the movie, the people who were actually giving information. And you had a very knowledgeable cast. That's one of the things I really enjoyed about it. You had a very knowledgeable cast of historians and storytellers, people who were breaking down the massacre, as you said, from beginning to end, what happened in 1898. And for those who haven't seen the movie, can you tell our audience who were some of your cast members and how were you able to get some of those, especially some of the more well-named cast members, how were you able to get them to agree to be a part of your film?
Well, no, you know, one, you know, when I reached out, I know you probably saw the one brother, the Rastafarian brother. I think his name was Larry Rennie Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
he was one of the first people I reached out to when I was putting this thing together. And I saw him just through Google, man, just Google researching, and his name kept popping up. And I saw he had some videos on YouTube, and I saw that he had an organization that was actually out there, you know, seeking direct descendants of some of the victims of the 1898 massacre, because his organization was all about pushing for reparations for these descendants. So he was one of the first people I reached out to, and he kind of helped me also to get up with people like Professor Sandy Darity. And a lot of people might be familiar with Professor Sandy Darity from Duke, because he always talks about the wealth disparity, and he's been getting a lot of play lately as well on like Tone Talks and Yvette Carnell Show and stuff like that,
right,
talking about the wealth gap. So when I reached out to him, he definitely wanted to get involved. Pretty much everybody who I reached out to, like Professor Darity, we also got Dr. Lewin Manley. He's the grandson of Alex Manley. And if anybody is familiar with the 1898 story, Alex Manley's name always pops up. He was the black newspaper editor whose newspaper was burned down. So we got his grandson in the film. We also got the great-granddaughter of Thomas C. Miller in the film, Faith Chaplin. And her great-grandfather was one of the wealthiest black men in Wilmington back then. And he was ran out of town, and all his property was taken as well. So we have his great-granddaughter in the film. We also have this white lady named Lorraine Unfleet, and she actually wrote the official state report for the state of North Carolina on the 1898 massacre. And we also have this white dude named Kent Chatfield. He's an independent researcher. He contributed a lot of research to the state report. And he's been, you know, he's heard the stories. He's, you know, since he grew up in Wilmington, and he was like one of those people on the inside, you know, those white cats that, you know, were on the inside and then they kind of dropped down on everybody. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. He was one of those guys that really exposed a lot of secrecy that has been held from the black community all these years, things that we didn't know about. And he was willing to come forth with that. So, you know, we got him in the film. We also have Dr. Umar Johnson that a lot of people are familiar with. And Umar, I reached out to him, and he said, yeah, I want to do this, man. I'm familiar with the story. And just let me know when you want to do the interview. And that was it. And pretty much everybody who we had in the film, you know, who I reached out to, they were down to be in it. But I think everyone really wanted this story to be told, and I think everyone was waiting for someone to put something together like this. So when I presented the opportunity, everybody jumped on board.
Right. Like I said earlier, the film was put together, and just the way the information was explained, like even the part where it was talking about the Gatling gun, how it was used on the men, women, and children, and just like the brutality, the amount of brutality that was inflicted upon our people, and for us to learn about this, but also understand that this was not an isolated event. Things like this happened to black communities all over the country, and so that's one of the greatest things about your film is hopefully. I know for people like me, but hopefully for other people, it causes them to do more research on what actually happened within these black communities.
Yes, you're right. And that's another reason why I wanted to do this is that sometimes when I do a screening, you know, you'll have someone say, well, you know, this isn't nothing new and they did this all over. But yeah, they did. But the thing is, they did it here and I wanted to expose it, you know, for what it was.
Right.
I think anyone, if... You know, everyone should look in their own backyard and really find out what's there. And if you could write a book, do a documentary or something, you know, do something to really expose it, you know, and be able to teach your people so we can learn from our mistakes, man. That's why I really like doing documentaries. It's just not to teach us history. It's also so we can learn from certain mistakes that we made in the past so we won't make those same mistakes again.
There you go. That's one of the greatest
things. I like that because that's, you know, like that's what... I would consider myself a strategist or a tactician, and a big part of that is knowing history. So you and that's, in my opinion, one of the components that's missing from today's activism is the historical lessons. You know, you got a lot of people that are activists that are doing things, but if they just spent a little more time studying history, they would understand that what you think is brand new has been done before. We already have the results of that experiment.
Exactly.
So I love it when you say stuff like that. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Sorry. Go ahead. No, I got it when he said, because we don't, like, how often do you hear somebody say that?
Nah, I mean, I feel you, because people really don't say that. I think that's why we continue to repeat history, so.
Yeah. And just like with our people, man, it's like we still trying to fight for integration.
Right.
Going there, you know, the type of integration that we're trying to fight for, it's not working. You know, it's still not working. So it's like, why are we continuing to do the same thing?
That's a fact. So that kind of leads us into our next question. So out there, we often hear, you know, black people, the reason why we haven't accumulated a lot of wealth is because we're lazy, we don't want to work the system and all that kind of stuff. Your movie tells the story of the American coup d'etat, which resulted in a lot of wealth and of the population being transferred to other people away from our communities and stuff like that. So can you help the audience understand why these events happened and what was the long-term effects of such events?
Yeah, well, you know, it happened before these type of events. You know, the first event was slavery. You know, that pretty much, you know, we didn't own and control nothing there because we were slaves. And then once we got free from slavery, you know, some of us might have got a few resources. Some of us might have got a little land. It depends on, you know, if our slave master had some type of heart to him. You know, he might have left us a little something here and there, you know what I'm saying? But for the most part, you know, a lot of African Americans really didn't have anything to work with. But, you know, we took our tools and fuels and put them together, you know, and made it happen, made it work out the best way we could. And we were able to build some businesses. Even the black people that had resources, they didn't say, like a lot of black people now with resources, say, pull yourself up by the bootstrap. I got mine, you get yours. They said, nah, you know, we're going to take our land that we got and we're going to build a school on it. You know what I'm saying? We're going to create some businesses here for our people so we can thrive. Because even though they might have had some resources come out of slavery, they still couldn't stay around white folks. So they still had to be around us. You see what I'm saying? So we had to work together. And then you had things like Wilmington Massacre and Tulsa and Rosewood and Jim Crow laws that pretty much destroyed that advancement after slavery, you know, and set us back some more years, you know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And then you have the Civil Rights Movement, you know, where we thought integration was the way, and then what we really found out, you know, we gave up the stuff that we had. We really didn't need to give up our stuff. We just needed the resources, you know, that we never really got after slavery. You know what I'm saying? We just need to really strengthen our communities and our institutions. You know, if we just would have got the resources instead of integrating, man, we'd be some powerful people right now. But, you know, I guess we thought that, you know, that was the way for us just to be around white people and they would just change their hearts. But it just didn't happen. But, you know, as a result of all of that, you know, of us losing our property, losing our land, we lost that generational wealth. You know what I'm saying, that we never really could pass down, you know, from generation to generation. And I know Professor Darity talks about this all the time. People are familiar with him. You know, he's real big now with this whole wealth gap, this black wealth gap. And it stems from all that. It stems from slavery. It stems from years of Jim Crow segregation, from redlining, stealing, the theft of property, high unemployment, lack of access to capital to grow your business or to establish a business. All these things are racist, white supremacy acts to keep black people down and marginalized. And we are seeing the results of it right now. And even Professor Darity, a lot of stuff we couldn't use because it didn't specifically focus on Wilmington. But when I sat down with him, he broke down the stat. He was saying that, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's just black people just aren't trying hard enough. Well, black people are just lazy, or we don't go to school. And he broke it all down. He said, no, that's true at all. He was saying that black people, we actually save more than white people, you know, on average. And it's a whole bunch of things we do on equivalent to white people. But he was saying that it has nothing to do with that. He was saying that you saving and all this stuff, you can't save your way out of poverty. It's just no possibility because you got inflation and all type of other stuff that are the factors. You know what I'm saying? So he was just saying that it's the whole thing of generational wealth. Slavery and Jim Crow, America has never addressed those issues. And they never addressed that issue of the access to the resources. And that has been the major issue for black people. And that's why we're in this current situation that we are today.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted to ask this because you made me think about something because a friend of ours, Professor Carl Tone Jones, he's always talking about one of the best things or one of the greatest things that black people have to do when they create their own communities or seek independence is to be able to protect themselves. And it was clear in this that they were not able to protect themselves. I mean, if you got handguns versus a prototype Gatling gun, you won't be able to protect themselves. So, exactly. Like, from your historical research, like, what advice would you give to others on methods and means and just, like, just ideas behind protecting what you build, especially protecting
the supremacy? Oh, yeah, and that's one of the lessons right there that we all can learn from, especially our people, is that we have to build an economic base first. And once we build an economic base, we have to protect it because mm-hmm. we see what will happen, Wilmington, Tulsa, Rosewood, and countless others of things. And also, like I said, we have to protect it. And that goes to practicing our amendments, our amendment rights. It's our right to bear arms and protect what we got. You know what I'm saying? That's our constitutional right. And, we need to really do that. And you're seeing a lot of African-Americans do that now. You know, a lot of African-Americans are starting their own gun clubs and mm-hmm. doing things like that, getting their permits and everything. So you're seeing a rise in that. So I think a lot of our people are starting to wake up in regards to a lot of the stuff that's going on with police brutality, the resurgence of a lot of hate groups and stuff. So a lot of our people are starting to arm themselves, in the proper way now. So, but that's Professor Carl Tone Jones is right on the money with that. You know, we have to protect our stuff. We have to protect ourselves. You know, once we get our economic basis on it, we have to protect. But also, it's still, politics still comes into play as well. We still have to have some political power as well because, with certain places, if they didn't use the gun, they used the laws. You know, they would put a highway through the black community and destroy it that way. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So if they didn't do it through the gun, they would just do it through certain type of laws where they would just put like a highway through the black area and totally destroy it like that. So, all of it kind of works hand in hand.
Yeah, that's how the black community in Richmond, Virginia got destroyed. They ran a highway right through the middle of it.
We had a Black Wall Street in Durham as well, through the Hayside District, and they did the same thing, put a highway right through that joint, even with Tulsa. You know, when Tulsa was destroyed in 1921, they rebuilt it back.
Right.
And they rebuilt it bigger than ever. And then the next thing they did, they put a highway through that joint. You can see the highway now when you go visit. It's right through it still to this day.
Yep. Urban development. Well, that's not even urban development. That's I forget the term. But, yeah. You know what, though? I was really happy that because I love Professor Daugherty, Dr. Daugherty. My friend, Dr. Maisha Williams, she's an economics professor. And she put me on to him a couple years back. And, I'm big into numbers and stuff. And that's practically all he is numbers.
Yeah.
And statistics and stuff like that and the way he breaks things down. You know, so I was so happy that he got shine, and even the way he breaks, the way he breaks stuff down, the way he analyzes the numbers, the way I think she was telling me he had almost created his own form of statistics with stratification economics, and that was kind of his field that he had kind of created. That is a brilliant brother, and it was so wonderful to see him getting that type of shine.
He's one of these guys, he's not like, like a lot of these academic guys, man, they're real stuck up. And if you're not like Spike Lee or these big people like CNN networks or ESPN, MSNBC, but he's down to earth, man. He said, "Hey, Chris, whenever you want to do something, just hit me up. Let's do it." and we definitely you definitely need people like that.
Yeah.
That's in academia, who really know what they're talking about, who got the stats, who got the facts and everything, and who's willing to really relay the information with our people.
Yeah, I was because that's one of the dudes I feel like brings so much to the table but doesn't get a lot of attention, doesn't get a lot of shine. And, you know, it's probably because he's not looking for it. But the brother brings a lot to the table. A lot of the things that have become, quote-unquote, common knowledge in the community that are negative things, like the education thing, like the poverty thing, and the even, you know, I was listening to one of his lectures a year or so ago where he was talking about the upward mobility, comparing the upward mobility of Africans that come to America to Americans. And, you know, that was the first time I heard anybody use the term sideways mobility. You know, the dude is just bonkers. So, but I wanted to ask you if you could, for our listeners and those who haven't seen the movie, and if they haven't, they really should go check it out. Break down propaganda. Help people understand propaganda, the various different ways that it has been utilized, you know, if it's still being utilized, what it is. Can you just walk our listeners through propaganda and why it's something that they should be familiar with?
Well, for your listeners who want to check out the film, they can go to WilmingtonOnFire.com, WilmingtonOnFire.com. You can get the DVD on there, and you can get the digital download on there as well, WilmingtonOnFire.com. But propaganda, man, they definitely use propaganda heavily with the 1898 massacre. But they've done it with all the massacres. And that was one of the strategies, was to pretty much, you know, change the image of black people. You know what I'm saying? And they had to condition people, similar to what Adolf Hitler did with the Jews. Every movement of white supremacy or dictatorship or whatever uses this type of strategy of propaganda to really change the minds of the people who they're about to pretty much wipe out or do something bad to. And they also are not only changing their mindset, but they're also changing the mindset of their allies as well. So even though they might know that this is wrong, they've been conditioned to feel like, okay, well, these people are not that human anyway, or they deserve to get what has came to them, so let me just fall back and not even say anything or do anything about it. And you see that stuff happening today, but it was really prevalent in 1898 during the massacre. What they did back then, the type of propaganda they would use, was pretty much what you see now, you know, calling black people lazy, living off the system. Certain black people who held political office, they would put out political cartoons through the major media outlets back then, which were your newspapers. And a lot of your white supremacists that were, you know, affiliated with, like, the Democratic Party, a lot of them owned the major newspapers back then. So, and also, a lot of white people couldn't read as well either, that well, back then. So they took advantage of people's stupidity. And they would use certain cartoons to relay the message of that propaganda throughout the newspapers, and they would just put cartoons of, you know, black people looking like beasts, you know, and they would have like a big black dude, you know, looking like, you know, the devil somewhat, and they'd have like a pretty dainty little white woman, you know, in the middle. You know what I'm saying? Like the brother is about to snatch up his white woman. And that's what they would put out there, that, you know, black people getting too successful, or they would put out the salary of a black politician and say, hey, your tax dollars is going to pay this black congressman, you know, $3,000 a year. You know, we need to put a stop to that. You know what I'm saying? They would do all that type of stuff, man. Or they would just make up certain stories saying that a black person robbed somebody, a black person raped a white woman. You know what I'm saying? So they would just put out fake stories and bogus stories to play, you know, to play in the mind and the fears of white society. And also, it played into the minds of black people as well. Then you had black people starting believing this, saying that, well, it's probably our own fault that we're being mistreated like this. You know, we need to get better. We need to do better. You know what I'm saying? We need to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps even more and all that, and we need to show white people that we're not really like this. You know, so when the massacre happened, a lot of people, you know, one of the big things they used with the propaganda with 1898 was they used an article by Alex Manly, and we have his grandson in the film. But Alex Manly wrote a rebuttal article against this white supremacist lady, Rebecca Felton, from Savannah, and she pretty much did a speech, you know, telling white men to lynch brothers because they were on these farms, you know, after slavery, working on the farm with these white women, and the white men weren't able to protect them. So white men need to stand up and bear arms and lynch as many black men as they possibly can. So Manley had a newspaper, and he wrote an article about it in response. And was saying that, you know, the stuff that she's saying is pretty much BS, and that it's only when the white women get caught is when they want to scream rape, and a lot of white women are attracted to brothers. And not being very sexual to brothers. And he was saying that the real issue is white men raping black women. And you know, so he put it out there, you know, straight up. So what the white supremacists did, they used that article and just put it all over the state of North Carolina and ran with it. And it really, you know, played into the fears of white society, especially white men, that we need to take down this threat of Negro progress because getting out of hand, and we need to go ahead and take this down now. And so that's what happened, you know, on November 10th, 1898.
And it's one thing I think a lot of people should research, you know, that's going back. But if you go back and look at how Nazi Germany did their propaganda campaigns before they went on the, you know, what Hitler went on and did, it's almost textbook similar to the same thing that went down in Wilmington. You know, it kind of set the pretense of, you know, if we can make these people out to be an enemy or a hindrance on society, when we go around and start rounding up, killing them and taking their property, it's going to go over a lot easier because we've already conditioned these people's minds to believe that. And you still see that today.
Why you always have these police officers getting off.
Yeah, what's the guy, Joseph?
You always, you know, you notice that even if they have some black jurors on the thing, man, even the black jurors will still take the police officer's side.
But people don't even understand that they're being conditioned to think that way or feel that way through propaganda. And like what Joseph Goebbels, I think his name is, he was the propaganda minister for Hitler. He literally wrote the book on propaganda, and he made it sound like the Jews were the salt of the earth. They were the worst thing. So when those things went to happen, you had all these people who probably didn't even have issues with them, but they went along with what was happening because these people are a problem, this, that, and other. And it's literally happening right here to black people in America right now.
Now, another thing that was significant, though, like he alluded to earlier, the burning down of Alex Manley's newspaper and running him out of town, because Alex Manley's newspaper was it was more popular than the white newspaper, correct?
Yes, it was very successful. Yes, right. Because, you know, Alex Manley at that time, you know, black people were Republican back then. You know,
mm-hmm.
He pretty much rocked with the Republican Party. And his paper, you know, catered to the Republican movement back then. It was real popular. You know, he had white advertisers, and he had white advertisers. You know what I'm saying? So his paper was real thriving. It was doing its thing. And it was a daily newspaper. You know, a lot of black people, we only had weeklies back in those days. Because, you know, if you do a daily paper, it was expensive. But he was able to, you know, have a daily paper, and it was doing real well. So they had to take that down. And that's why a lot of times the story didn't really get out to a lot of places of what was really going on. Because, see, the white supremacists, what they did was when they destroyed Manley's paper, and then they put out what happened,
right,
which was BS. You know, so they put out, because, see, the first story they put out was that black people caused the massacre. Like, it was something like a black person pulled out a gun, and then white people had to defend themselves. You know, and then only two people were killed and a few people were hurt, but, you know, pieces were stored. And when you look at the old newspapers, you see that. And it was coming from those white supremacist, you know, newspapers, you know what I'm saying? And that was a story for years until African Americans started leaving Wilmington and really telling the real deal, you know, through certain books and novels. And, you know, and they hooked up with other black newspapers throughout the country and started sharing what really happened.
Right. Okay.
Yes, that's similar to, I think, the very first book I read on what happened in Tulsa was written by, I forget the guy's name, but he was a white guy. The book was actually written in the 1950s. But he put the entire blame for the Tulsa incident squarely on, and I need to find that book so I can share it. Just so I can kind of like corroborate, you know, exactly what you're saying. He put the blame for the massacre squarely on the black community. And this was like in an actual book, like was like context are presented as a historical researched book on what happened in the Greenwood community. But, you know, going back to that thing you guys were talking about with propaganda, and how you were saying they would flip the script, and how you guys were saying that, you know, we even still nowadays have black people that don't understand that they've been conditioned by what they're seeing. That takes me back to Ida B. Wells, who prior to her releasing her publications on lynchings and things like that, a good chunk of the black population even believed that most of the blacks that were lynched were criminals. Like, they deserved it. They earned it. They did something. It wasn't until she released that and other people started coming out with information that we were able to put two and two together and realize, wait, they not lynching criminals. They lynching anybody that they deem to be, you know, uppity, out of pocket, out of place, doing something they ain't got no business, being somewhere they shouldn't be. They basically just lynching whoever they want whenever they feel like it. So it's always interesting because we have all these instances historically of our people being manipulated to believe that the people who are of our community that are getting abused, mistreated, murdered, whatever, in public have somehow earned it. And even though we have all these historical representations, we still continue to believe that in this modern day, those black people that get abused or murdered or oppressed or whatever have earned it. That's a wonderful lesson that we don't seem to be learning. Why do you think that is?
I guess because we don't really understand propaganda. And that's why, you know, I'm glad Umar really breaks it down. You know, Umar Johnson, he really breaks it down in the film, man, and really shows, like, why black people, why we don't understand it and, you know, and how we need to understand it, you know, so this type of stuff won't happen again. You know, I guess, I don't know, man, just like just our people, man. I think a big thing with our people, man, we watch too much TV, you know what I'm saying, and other things like that. But you have to look at TV and put it in context for what it is. You know, I think a lot of our people, man, we look at TV, we look at this music industry and entertainment industry, man, we take it as just being the gospel. You know, we really don't understand that they program it. You know what I'm saying? We don't control none of this stuff. You know what I'm saying? And but yet we still, you know, just fall for it, man. And I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take for us to really learn.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know either. But I hope we learn it soon. I hope we learn it soon. I know our historians are doing their best, and even you with your family doing the best, but I hope we learn, because those of us who don't learn will suffer greatly. So my question now is, before, during, and after this film, like, what type of challenges did you face? Also, did you face any racist backlash as you were making this film? How were you able to overcome your challenges? And if you faced racist backlash, how were you able to overcome that and still be successful in your endeavors?
Well, the biggest hurdle, man, it really, I didn't have any backlash. Because how I did this thing, I kind of did it low-key, you know, under the radar within, you know, Wilmington community. But I built up a nice social media following as well. But a lot of people still didn't think I was coming out with a film, because a lot of people have attempted to do what I did with this project, you know what I'm saying? But they never really completed it, you know what I'm saying? They would talk about doing something. Even big Hollywood people were talking about doing a project on 1898. But nothing never happened. So I guess people thought that the same thing was going to happen with my project. And it almost did, you know, because it took a lot of money, and I ran out of money. But luckily, that was my biggest challenge, man, was really the financial aspect to get everything together. But out of the blue, man, I had an NBA player, David West. He plays with the Golden State Warriors right now. Mm-hmm. He reached out to him. He had his business manager reach out. This was like 2015. And I thought it was somebody playing a joke. I was like, man, I'm familiar with the brother. You know, I'm a fan of his. I know this dude ain't trying to pay attention to what I'm doing. You know what I'm saying? So who's playing around? You know what I mean? Who's hitting me up? Like, who's playing? But it was serious, man, and he was actually following myself. So my social media campaign actually worked. You know what I'm saying? He caught his eye. And he was actually following the film for a couple of years, and he wanted the DVD. And I said, yo, the film ain't done. You know, I need X amount of money to get it done, but whenever I get it done, I'll let you know, and you can get a DVD. He said, how much you need? And I told him, and he said, well, let's make that happen. And the rest is history. And that's how I was able to get the thing, you know, completed and get it out. And there hasn't really been a racial backlash, man, because if you probably researched me and researched some of my screenings and seen some of the pictures at my screenings, you'll a lot of times see there's a lot of white people there.
Mm-hmm.
And we pack it out. We have like 200, 300, 500, 700 people in certain screenings.
That's good.
And a lot of times, especially in Wilmington, man, in Wilmington specifically, it's always about 80, 90% white. And the biggest backlash that I've gotten, which I didn't expect, has been from the black community.
I knew it.
It goes back to that propaganda, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It goes back to that propaganda. The biggest backlash I have gotten has been from the black community, man. I've had people send me extortion letters. I've had people try to sabotage my screenings. I've had people try to badmouth me, you know, saying that, you know, I'm robbing the community. I stole history, and I'm making all this money off of it. Everything, man.
That right there. Every time I think, every time somebody from my own community try to, you know, create that type of awareness.
Yeah.
A lot of it, I think, is, you know, is because we've been conditioned to, oh, he's trying to do some good. He's just trying to make some money off of it, and we're afraid that person's going to do better than us or become famous, whatever the case may be. And another part of that, I think a lot of it is these people are purposely being sent some way, some shape or form, just to throw dirt or salt on a situation. You can see that with all our scholars. Anytime something happens, oh, they robbing this or they taking
But I noticed this, right? When I was putting this thing together, now I noticed that a lot of people that write books or do films on the black experience and black history are white folks. And now they're the ones that's making the big money.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. They get these big major book deals. They get these big distribution deals, the whole nine. You know what I'm saying? They're the ones that's really making top dollar. You know, I make a few bucks here and there, but it all goes into promotion of the film and also to the next film going. Because it takes money. If you like these type of films, you know it takes money to do these things. And if you want it high quality, it takes money. You know what I'm saying?
But even with that,
money to make films is...
I would rather see you eat. I would rather see you prosper financially off of you making something, because you got it from the dirt, versus somebody who's just coming out and just sucking up the culture just to make a profit off it. At least you got it from the dirt. You came from this. You from North Carolina. You know, it's a little bit more authentic coming from you, but we don't want authentic. We don't want that for some reason.
But see, a lot of times, man, it's like you go back, man, it's the jealousy. Because like I said, man, even when I put this thing together, I didn't really have a lot of full support from the black community in Wilmington like that. You know, I had a few people, but most of it came from outside, like David West and others. Even Tariq Nasheed helped me out, man, in the beginning. He's one of my producers as well. He gave me some dollars to get this thing going. You know what I'm saying? And then David West came at the end. You know what I'm saying? So it came from brothers that had no ties to Wilmington at all. They love history, and they felt like, you know, Chris, you're doing a quality project, and we got to support this. You know what I'm saying? And but a lot of African Americans in Wilmington, man, it's like I think a lot of them, they complain about wanting to do something or do something like this. They never did. So why not me for putting the initiative in and doing it? I don't get it.
There you go. And shout out to David West. David West always showing up when unexpected. I've heard about at least four or five different occasions where he's put his own money up to help projects. So shout out to David West.
Yeah, man, and I'm a prime example, man. He didn't even know me. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And he was like, hey, Chris, he said, man, I like what you're doing. This project needs to be out here. Here's the money. Let's do it. And that's how it happened.
I think black people, though, they I think part of it is jealousy. I also think a part of it is loneliness. Black people, they don't want to see somebody coming up unless they taking them with them. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't want to be left alone in their misery, in their poverty in their state. So I think that's it. And I think they're especially connected to, are sensitive to other black people doing things. But then, too, I think there's just like a failure to understand the way the world works almost. I don't want to say it like that, but that's the only way I can think to say it right now. Where you have, like you said, brother, if you want quality projects, it costs money. And at the same time, it costs time. Like, you can't expect me to put out a quality feature-length movie project in a reasonable amount of time and work a 9-to-5. Like, if you want me to produce movies on a professional level, I need to eat. Exactly. You know, like, I have a powerful urge every day to take a bite of something.
Right.
And your gratitude, although it's well appreciated, I can't eat that. You know, I can't pay my light bill with that. I can't. So I don't even understand. And I feel what you're saying, because I know several people that have published books that have done smaller projects, nothing like a feature-length documentary, but they have done smaller projects. You know, they've done other things where they've tried to provide information to the community, provide some historical context for a certain event, but at the same time, they were charging for it because they got to eat.
Right.
And I've seen that backlash time and time again of, you know, when you say that, it registers immediately. Oh, you're just trying to pimp our history. You're just trying to pimp our culture. You're just trying to...
See, man, people don't realize, man, like, we would do a screening, right? You have to rent the venue. And a lot of times the venue costs $800 to $1,000. Then you got to get event insurance. You know, you got to get like a $5 million policy to cover it. You know what I'm saying? Which is going to run you about $300. And then, so that's, you already over a grand right there. Then you got to pay for the posters to get printed. That's a couple hundred dollars. You know what I'm saying? And you already like close to $2,000 in the hole before you even did the screening.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. It take it to make it. And but it goes back to that creating that mindset of we have to support our own. And when we're talking about supporting our own, we're talking about from the ground up. Don't just support me after I've blown up.
Right.
Support me from the ground up, because if we support each other from the ground up, more people will blow up and more will understand that process.
But that's what I try to do, man. Like, I have a couple of cats right now. They have great documentaries, and I'll send you their info as well off the air. But I try to do the same thing. You know, since David West and Tariq and other people, my man Pete Chapman, they helped me with my project. I try to do the same with other brothers and sisters out here who are doing film. Like, I got one brother now. He about to drop his joint. You might have heard about it on social media. It's on the Black Bike Week in Myrtle Beach. It's called Black Beach, White Beach, Tale of Two Beaches. Powerful documentary.
Okay.
It's coming out. I'm a producer on that. I've got him through the process, kind of mentored him. His joint about to drop soon in a couple of months. I got his other brother as well. He has a great documentary that's coming out. So I try to do that, man. I try to bring other documentary filmmakers and other filmmakers up as well. Try to school them to the game, give them tips. I even invest in their projects as well. You know what I'm saying? Because I can't be the only one out here doing this.
Right.
You know, we need a whole bunch of filmmakers, man, because this is what the white guys do. You know what I'm saying? You see these white cats all the time bringing in these new filmmakers, these new actors and actresses all the time. You know what I'm saying? And that's what we got to do, the same thing. So I try to lead by example.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
No, I think back to kind of what you were saying, Joe, like, people wait till you get a little bit of clout and some recognition, then they want to come along, but nobody wants to help you when you're literally at the dirt level trying to get it out. So we got to change that mindset, especially within our own community. Like, if you see somebody doing something, who cares? If they're going to be successful, great. At least you help. You were a part of that. And I think a lot of people that fear, I don't want somebody to do better than me, some crab in the barrel
type
stuff.
It's like, you know, they want you to be successful, but not on their dime.
Yeah, not too successful. Hey, I'll give you this, but don't you blow up and make more money than me. It's like, get out of here, man. We can throw money away on, you know, just simple stuff. You know, eating at freaking McDonald's on the weekend. Well, you could take that $20 and give it to somebody's project and not think twice about it. But black people, we got a tendency. I give you $20. I want a full, you know, stock report. I want everything of how you spent this $20 funky. I want to know what you brought with it. Break it down.
They want the full business plan.
Come on, man. Donate that little funky ass $20 and forget about it. At least you did something to help somebody else out that's gonna benefit your own community. Like, we really gotta stop doing that, man. That's crazy.
Yes, sir. So let me ask this. When people watch your film, especially black people, when our people watch your film, what would you like our people to gain from your film? What takeaways would you like them to have from the film, as well as how do you feel your film can be used as a tool for empowerment of black, for the empowerment of black people?
Well, I want people to take away from my film is just knowing your history, knowing propaganda, and we got to learn from our mistakes of the past. I think those are the things I want people. That's what I always emphasize anytime I do the Q&As and stuff after the screening, are those things. And also, start the history of your own backyard. You'd be surprised what you'll find. And it don't matter how small the town is or how big the city is. There's always something there that you never need over there. You know what I'm saying? So those are the type of things that I really try to emphasize to people anytime, you know, when it comes to my film. We got to realize, we got to know how white supremacy works and how it operates. And we got to realize that white supremacy and this system of racism, white supremacy, it doesn't operate like we do. You know, see, we think tomorrow, next week. You know, when these people did this massacre, what I want people to realize is that they plotted on this after the end of the Civil War. You know what I'm saying? So they'll take 30, 40, 50, 60 years to strategize and plot and plan. That's how they think. And we have to start thinking the same way. We have to stop living for just tomorrow or next week. We got to start planning and building for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And that's one of the reasons why I started my own business, started my own film company, because right. I want to be able to pass something down, hopefully, one day to my nieces and nephew, or if I ever have any kids, you know what I'm saying? Because I'm looking 20, 30 years down the road. You know, right now it might not be nothing but a couple of films under the film company's belt. But 10, 20 years down the road, I might have a slew of films, you know what I'm saying, where they can always eat from and have that generational wealth to work off of, where they can go out and start their own thing or continue the family business. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So those are the things that that I hope the film can be used for, to empower our people of that knowledge of we have to build generational wealth. We have to learn from mistakes of the past, and we have to understand what propaganda is as well, and also understand how white supremacy operates. They operate 10, 20, 30 years with a plan, and we have to do the same thing to fight it. You know what I'm saying? We can't think like, well, next week, it'll be over. Nah, we have to continue to strategize and mobilize against it and also build up our economic base as well at the same time and protect it.
There you go. So as far as future projects for Mr. Christopher Everett, you have this award-winning film. And so what future projects do you have? And also, can you elaborate on some of the awards the film has garnered?
Well, some of the awards for Wilmington on Fire, man, we won Best Documentary at the North Carolina Black Film Festival last year. Won Best Documentary at Film Spark Film Festival in North Carolina last year. We also won the Longleaf Best Historical Documentary Award. And we also won, the biggest one to date has been the Pan-African Film Festival, where I won Best Director. For a first time documentary, and right. We went there at the Pan African Film Festival. Man, that was huge. It was out in L.A. And Danny Glover, he's one of the founders of the festival, and it's big. It's real big, man. It's like 4 weeks, like a whole month festival, and a lot of big, you know, cats out of Hollywood was there and everything. It was amazing. It was my first time in L.A. and everything, and I didn't think I was gonna win anything. You know, I was just happy to be there. You know, and selected. And then, you know, after the festival was over, they said, "Hey, Chris, you won." I'm like, "Oh, wow." You know, so I think that was the biggest one, man. And that really showed me that that the film has resonated outside of Wilmington and outside of North Carolina, because it's starting to screen everywhere. We just screened in Chicago last month at the Black Harvest Film Festival. I think we packed in about 200 people for that. You know, so it's like wherever we screen, man, we have an audience that wants to know. And I think because they see the similarities to what's still going on now. I think that's really what's getting people excited to see this film, because the same stuff is still happening. And then they see the film, it's okay, they can put two and two together and see what's really going on. But those are some of the awards that we've won. And we've been featured in like some major publications like the New Yorker, NPR, New York Times, Rolling Out Magazine, you know, over the years. But a couple of projects, the next project I got two projects, actually. One project I actually bought the distribution rights for, and it's a film that we're going to come out with. We're currently remastering it and doing the restoration to it, because it's an old film. It's like from 2001. But it's called As an Act of Protest. And it's pretty much, it was a film that was banned in New York when it came out by Mayor Giuliani because of the subject matter. And it kind of went underground through, like, the film festival circuit and, you know, underground theaters and stuff like that, and on VHS. And it was real big overseas in Europe for a few years. Then it kind of died away. But I knew the filmmaker personally, and he liked what I did with Wilmington on Fire, building, like, a grassroots campaign movement and a big social media movement. And he was getting, you know, kind of rid of some of his assets and stuff, and he thought I'd be a great person to really do something with his film, because I was always a fan of the film, and I felt like it had a voice and something definitely that we needed now more than ever. And the film is pretty much about an actor who is an artist who's conflicted on what to do about racism, white supremacy, and actually takes a stand against police brutality by force. And that was one reason why the film was banned, because when it was trying to come out, 9/11 had just happened in New York. So, you know, they really wasn't trying to have that. And that's why I felt the film is definitely needed now, especially since the height of all these police brutality cases and murders and everything that happened. I think black people, we need a film like this. And we've done several little test screenings just to see, you know, if people are interested, and they have. We've, you know, brought out a couple of screens we had of the film so far in North Carolina. We put about 50 to 60 people, you know, in the seat.
Okay.
Came out to see it. So what we're doing right now is doing the restoration process so we can put it out on DVD and also expand it into other theaters, you know, across the country, and start doing some more screenings and creating more dialogue from the film as well. And we're going to put that out probably. It's going to probably be ready by February. We're trying to drop it in Black History Month. So that's that one. And the next joint that I'm filming actually in December is a documentary. And it's on the life, martial arts career, and teachings of Grandmaster Vic Moore. And Vic Moore, a lot of people might be familiar with him. He's like a four-time world karate champion. You know, a lot of people might have seen him on the internet talking about his famous speed competition against Bruce Lee in
1990. Yes. I did see that.
That's who we're doing the documentary on. And me and him, you know, we've talked about doing this for a couple of years now, and, you know, he's getting up there in age. So I said, you know what, I want to get his flowers on while he's still living. So we're starting filming in December. Since the summer, we've been doing, you know, development, getting everybody involved. We're going to have some big names into it, man. We're going to have Chuck Norris in the joint. We're going to have the guy. You guys familiar with the film Bloodsport with Jean-Claude Van Damme back in the day? Well, you know, Van Damme, he actually played a dude named Frank Dukes.
Yeah.
That guy is a real guy. But he's going to be in the film. He said he's going to be in it because he actually studied under Grandmaster Moore for some years. And that's the reason why he was able to get into that Kumite tournament, because of Grandmaster Moore as well. You know, so he's going to talk about all of that. Of, you know, and all these people, man, we're going to have in the film who he fought against, who he's taught, who's inspired. You know, this man has done a lot for martial arts in general, and just a lot of people don't know about him. So, you know, I'm going to do pretty much what I did with Wilmington on Fire. You know, we're going to, you know, shine that light, and everybody's going to know who he is. And so he's excited about it. I'm excited about it. I can't wait to start filming in December. So hopefully we'll have it ready by next winter, next fall.
That's going to be That's gonna be cool. Cause now that what that story needs to be told, in my opinion, because you know in the black community we don't outside of Jim Kelly, we don't have any real black kung fu or martial art heroes. You know, it's always Bruce. It was Bruce Lee, Ip Man, Chuck Norris, and all these people. But you know,
Wesley Snipes. Hold on. Oh man.
Well,
Dragonfly
I mean,
Jones. What are you talking about?
Man, whatever. But no, it's like they not. Wesley not looked at looked in the same light as like a Jim Kelly, even though we know Wesley do got hands, and even Michael Jai White got hands, but like this guy, like,
you know, these guys like Vic Moore and Steve Muhammad, he's going to be in the film, but you know these guys, they was actually compete,
right?
Know, was
right,
like,
exactly.
It was tournament, you know, it wasn't Hollywood stuff, you know. And we're going to talk about all that in the film, man. How
that's good.
You know, the whole thing of martial arts and karate has been distorted over the years because people, you know, get the Hollywood stuff confused with the real deal, you know, karate, you know?
Yeah. Yep. And then Vic Moore gave the business to, Bruce Lee, too. So that needs to be told.
Yes.
Well, that's why I bring up, I didn't bring up a lot of those. I don't know about Michael Jai White, but unless my research is bad, and it could be, I do believe Wesley Snipes is legit with his.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, but I think they both are. I think him and pretty much, man, I'm trying to reach out to both of those guys. Once we start getting some filming going, I'm gonna reach out to both cats, man, and see if they want to be involved in being an executive producer or something.
Imagine Wesley Snipes saying no. I mean, he did the joint with John Henry Clark, so
exactly. So he's, you know, because see, I want to shoot some stuff first. You know, I like to come to the table with something already rolling. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's what I kind of did, you know, with David West. He reached out to me. You know, the film, you know, we was already rolling with it. So once I get everything rolling, I'm definitely going to reach out to both brothers and see if they want to be a part of this.
Yeah, sure. Because, you know, I used to compete back in the day, try to get my sons into it. They was like, nah, Pops, we ain't feeling that. So my dream dog.
That's all good. But, Before we start to wrap this up, can you tell our audience where they can find you on social media, websites, and every different means of communication with you?
Well, yeah, you can. They can hit me up, WilmingtonOnFire.com. WilmingtonOnFire.com. You can get Wilmington on Fire on there, digital download or DVD. You can also find us on Facebook as well, Facebook.com/WilmingtonOnFire. On Twitter at Wilmington 8258, also on Instagram Wilmington on Fire. They can hit me up on there. And also for your listeners too, since you're listening, I'm gonna give anyone who texts this number, if they just text this number that I'm about to put out, I'll send a free download of the Wilmington on Fire promotional soundtrack for free.
Okay.
And the number is 910-378-4357. They just text me, say, hey, Chris, or whatever. They text that number, man, and I'll send them a free download of the Wilmington on Fire promotional soundtrack.
Yes, sir. Definitely appreciate that. Definitely appreciate that. So this is this is our usual last question. This Patrick's favorite question, and so we kind of he's special, so we kind of set it up differently for him. So, Patrick, it is.
So, Joe Suck Your Life.
whatever.
If you were the all powerful, all knowing ruler of Black America, what would you change? And what would your message to the people be?
I repeat that question again.
Oh, yeah. If you were the all-knowing, all-powerful ruler of Black America, what would you change and what would your message to the people be?
I would tell us to stop hating each other. You know, let's build our own. You know what I'm saying? Let's fight for economic independence. That's what I would say.
Okay. stop hating each other, build our own, fight for economic independence. Straight to the point. Straight to the point.
Stop that hating.
So hating, man.
But that's important though. That is important because that is a we do often hear that in some of the answers that we hear for that question. So because with that particular question, we like to log the answers, because in a little bit we're gonna do something with it, but we just like to log the answers. But man, we appreciate you coming on the Freedom Train, giving us your time, so we can learn more about the movie, learn more about you and your upcoming projects, your endeavors, everything that you have going on. One more time before we leave, can you give people your social media and the different ways to contact you?
All right, Wilmington05.com, Wilmington05.com. You can get the DVD and the digital download right on Wilmington05.com. Also, Facebook.com/Wilmington on Fire. If you're on Facebook, we on there as well. Facebook.com/Wilmington on Fire. We're on Twitter, and we're at Wilmington1898, @Wilmington1898, and also on Instagram as well, Instagram.com/Wilmington on Fire. And also, if people want a free copy, a free download of the Wilmington on Fire promotional soundtrack, just text the number 910-378-4357, 910-378-4357, and I'll send you a free download of the Wilmington on Fire promo soundtrack.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, man. We definitely appreciate you for all your hard work, all your efforts, and you're definitely reaping the rewards of the effort that you put into what you're doing. The black community will be better because of what you've done. The more knowledge we have, the better we can move forward, because like we've expressed earlier, we're ignorant of our past, and because we're ignorant of our past, we keep repeating the same cycles over and over and wonder why we're having a hard time defeating white supremacy. We don't understand ourselves, and we don't understand white supremacy and how it works. And your film break gives a good synopsis on different ways, or a specific way, even many ways, white supremacy can be used to destroy its enemy in the black community. So my brother Christopher Everett, the director of the award-winning film Wilmington on Fire, we definitely appreciate you, my brother, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yes, sir. We will definitely talk to you later.
All right.
All right.
Oh.
Yes, sir. Hey, man, you got to know thyself. Jamie.
What's happening?
Know thyself.
I think I know myself.
You better.
Self known.
You better.
Hey, yo, Pat, what happened to your voice? And he's like, America.
Yeah,
what was that?
I went back to puberty for a minute,
though. Oh, man, that was funny. Yeah, it was funny because it happened.
Hey man, you got to check out Wilmington on Fire. It's a good movie. It's definitely
absolutely
very, very, very informative. Check it out, because you're gonna learn a lot. Especially, like I said, you're gonna learn a lot about how white supremacy works. So
that
man, I mean,
saying after you watched it, you text me up like, "Pat, man, this shit garbage," and I was like, "Joe,
nah,
I'm bullshitting."
Yeah, you better stop. I'm gonna write a diss song on you real quick, Pat. Hey man, but nah, that great information, man.
Absolutely.
So y'all make sure y'all check this out. Hey man, if you don't text that number and get your copy, I don't know what to tell you. He gave it out there for you, so make sure you be one of the first ones to do it.
I'm gonna text it on Thursday from all my phones.
Hey man, I'm Joseph Ward. He's Patrick Irvin. He's Jamie Basham. Together,
yeah,
with the Freedom Train podcast series. And I don't know what you ever been told before, but we the best. Hey.